I think what's unique about our students is because we're culinary arts and science and the lab is multidisciplinary, they're not just food technologists. They could go into a food technologist role, but we're seeing a lot more demand for students who can also do something else. So if they're a food technologist who can also cook at a culinary school level, or they also have a degree in nutrition and can help with compliance or help with the healthfulness of the products being developed, it gives them a lot more kind of appeal and versatility. And because all of our students get the consumer design work as part of their development, I think that helps as well.
On today's episode, we're speaking with Jonathan Deutsch, founder and director of Drexel University's Food Lab, about the art and science of food product research, development, and testing.
Hi, I'm Jonathan Deutsch. I'm a professor of culinary arts and science at Drexel University in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. And I am director of the Drexel Food Lab, which is a food product development and culinary innovation lab focused on improving the health of people, planet, and economies, and engaging our students in real-world product development and product design projects.
Amazing. Thanks, Jonathan. I'm excited to have you on the show because I am a big fan of anything that's solving food waste, and therefore got involved with the Upcycled Food Association, helping them launch their certification mark and stuff. And through there, learned about Drexel, and I just keep seeing your name pop up over and over, and I know you're doing a lot of amazing stuff. So I wanted to have you come on the show and kind of share your story and what you're all doing there. With that said, as part of the show, we also like to dive into people's backgrounds, like how'd you even get to where you are right now? So Before we talk too much about all that you're doing at the moment, I'd love to learn a little bit more about like how you got into food in the first place and why you decided to go for a PhD.
Sure. I come at food from the chef side. I've always wanted to be a cook and started cooking in restaurants and making pasta and sausage as an after-school job for Italian restaurants when I was 14. Just loved everything about it. Was really committed to doing this chef track. My parents were less enthusiastic. They're both PhDs in psychology and thought this was crazy. And what are you doing going to culinary school? You should go to college and get a real job, you know, that kind of approach, a real profession. But I just couldn't shake the kitchen. I loved and still love everything about it. And when I was in culinary school, did an externship at Nestle in their R&D division, because I loved cooking, but also was interested in the food science and the manufacturing and kind of the bigger picture. I'd never worked for a big company and wanted to try that out. And really discovered this world of research chef. So it didn't have a name at that time in the 90s. It was just called chefs at food companies. But since then, there's Research Chefs Association. I'm a certified research chef from that organization, and really found a way to balance my love of food and cooking with my kind of intellectual curiosity and wanting to keep stimulated and not just replicate the same dish for the same people in a restaurant fashion. And so that's been a really rewarding area for me. And so did that for a while, solely the research and development work, and then got into teaching. And for many years, I taught in New York and really kept those worlds separate. So I would teach kind of basic culinary school during the day and then moonlight as a product developer doing R&D projects. And at Drexel, had the opportunity to really combine those worlds. And we have students who are majoring in culinary arts and science or food science who are interested in this professionally, and what better way to teach than to do and to work with great partners through organizations like Upcycled Food Association and others and through our community to get that hands-on experience and really build those connections so that when students are ready to graduate, they're not speaking hypothetically about what value they could offer to an employer based on their education. But they're saying, remember, I did this project for you and as part of my education, and now I'm ready to graduate. And you said to text you if I ever need anything, and it's time. So it's been a really great project that sort of hits on multiple levels in terms of our goals.
That's awesome. I love that. I find some of the most rewarding or at least unique career paths come from when people combine multiple passions together. So you mentioned like your passion for culinary arts, and sure, you could have just gone and opened your own restaurant and ran a kitchen or something like that. But you also had this passion for research and development and kind of the more intellectual curiosity side of things. So like combining those two things makes for such a rich career path, which is cool.
Yeah, that's a great point. And we see that a lot with our students, you know, so we have students who are majoring in nutrition, they'll be successful, they're smart. But the students who also say, and I'm a personal trainer in addition to that, so I can combine those worlds, or I'm a chef and I can combine being a dietitian with being a chef. Those students have a much longer ladder and more breadth of options, I think, than anyone who's strictly housed in one discipline.
Yeah, and I find it also gives you more resiliency, because I was talking to a former boss who had put a lot of his identity in the fact that he was a runner. And so he was doing marathons all the time, but at a certain point, he injured his knee and could no longer run. And he went through like at least a 6 month or longer period of this kind of almost depression, like wondering who he is anymore if he can't go to these runs, if he's just there on the sideline cheering other people on. But over time, he realized, wait, running's not my only identity. I'm also an entrepreneur. I'm also a designer. I'm also a whatever. Yeah. So having multiple things that you're weaving your career around gives you resiliency in both your identity, but also your career path. Because then you're focused more on the problem, not the one solution you have. And you could kind of come at it from different angles.
Yeah, exactly. And I think the pandemic was a good lesson for those of us who are in hospitality, you know, the people who put all their eggs in the tourism, fine dining, filling up that dining room basket really struggled to adapt and maybe didn't and maybe closed. And those who saw it as an opportunity to say, well, there are a few truths here. One is that everyone needs to eat. Another one is that people don't really like to cook and aren't particularly good at it. And so if we can take the brand we've built and get into family dinners or ghost kitchens or any number of other packaged goods, we've done a lot of work over the pandemic helping restaurant chefs launch new CPG products based on recipes from their restaurants or new concepts. You know, I think that really shows that kind of resiliency you're talking about, rather than throwing up your hands and being mad at the world. You know, it may be fun to yell at the world, but it doesn't actually accomplish anything.
Yeah, for sure. It's like if you're focused on the problem, which is people need to eat, like you said, and one solution is they'll come into my restaurant and I'll feed them here. But like there are other solutions. I can make prepared meals. I can make packaged food. I can, you know, do meals on wheels. I can do delivery. You know, there's so many other ways. So
right. Classes. Yeah. You know.
Yeah. I heard of some wineries that pivoted by like shipping you wine and then doing online tastings where you could all get together on Zoom. So you just got to get creative. Yeah.
In some ways, what was really interesting, I wrote an article about a wine bar who did that. And in some ways, it took them further than their previous model. I mean, if you do a wine dinner at a restaurant, you know, maybe you can sell 40 or 50 seats to that. And you have the cost of the food and the cost of the wine and everything and the service staff. But if you're doing a Zoom class, you could have 100, 200 people logged in preparing their own food, paying comparable rates. You can have the winemaker who's in South Africa or France also joining you at no expense, right? Versus flying them over to do this event. And so I think that the savvy, resilient people always kind of find a way through this adversity.
Yeah. Necessity is the mother of invention. That quote, it's the same kind of thing, like a pandemic or whatever seems like the worst thing ever. But sometimes if you kind of have the right mindset, it can actually be the best thing that happened for your business because it opens your mind to different paths. With that said, you mentioned some time in New York. Was that with the Kingsborough Community College?
Yeah, I went to New York in 99 to go to grad school at NYU. I fell in love with teaching as an undergrad and a teaching assistant here at Drexel, and then decided to get my graduate degree. I went to the food studies program at NYU, really intended to be there for couple years to get my degree and get out and go anywhere in the world. And then took a job that I loved at Kingsborough Community College, which is part of the City University of New York system. And I started the culinary program there. They had a tourism and hospitality focused program heavily on travel and airlines and wanted to do more of not just getting people out of the city through the, we're close to JFK, But what happens when you come in and, you know, a little bit more of the destination marketing, the hotels and restaurants and so on. And New York was a great place to do that work. So I started that program there and then also taught a little bit at the graduate level in food studies as part of the Doctor of Public Health program. And so really like that kind of diversity of a class in the morning, teaching people basic knife skills, helping them get serve safe and their first restaurant job. And then teaching a dietitian about food studies theory, gastronomy, to help them earn their doctorate and be more professionally competent. And then along the same lines, you know, teaching cooking in the daytime and then going to an ideation, you know, for a product development project, you know, in the afternoon. It's just love the variety. It never gets old doing this kind of work.
Yeah, that's true. That's one of the things I love about running a business and maybe running like a department at a school or whatever is the same kind of thing, is that there's always a new challenge.
Yeah.
Every year, every quarter, every semester, whatever, there's going to be something a little different. But then you also have the opportunity to kind of run a couple different thing experiments at the same time and kind of see what sticks.
Exactly. Especially in new product development, because there's always new trends and new things being explored and new technologies that can be harnessed to do different things. And so it's really a welcome departure from some of my early work in food product development, which was sort of brand on the brand side, where it's like, okay, let's do some more cost reductions on the same product that you've done hundreds of trials on. And that's the part, you know, you have to pay your dues to get to the fun part, similar to restaurant work or any profession, I guess. But this is the creative and sort of front of funnel stuff is what really excites us on the design side.
Yeah. That's an interesting note. You know, I've never kind of worked internally at a big food company, and especially I haven't been on the product development side. So you mentioned that some of that work ends up being cost reduction. So they go to someone like you and say, we need to knock a few cents per unit or something off of this. How do we do that? And then you have to figure out like what you can replace, you know, ingredient wise or process.
Yeah, especially now, I mean, with supply chain stuff. So let's say the price of an ingredient doubles and that ingredient is 5% of the formula and there's no way around that cost, they might say, all right, well, see if we can reduce that to 4% of the formula. That'll save us a few cents or fractions of a cent, because when you're dealing with thousands, hundreds of thousands of units, that those fractions matter. And then do some sensory work to see if consumers can tell the difference, you know, do a triangle test. Here's the modified version as compared to the original version, randomly coded. Can you even tell the difference? And if someone says, oh, you know, I much prefer the 5% version, then you were unsuccessful, right? But if you can reduce cost or reduce fat or reduce any number of things without people telling the difference, then there's margin to be made without raising prices, right? So that seems to be a common project for new technologists. Reverse engineering is another big one. You know, something comes out.
Oh, yeah.
And they say, figure out how they did this or what's in it or whether we should launch something like that. And that can be pretty tedious too. You know, like, I know this thing has garlic flavor, but I don't know who their vendor is. So I'm gonna try like 20 or 25 different garlic flavors and see which one is closest to the one on the market. It's a lot of that kind of work.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, I have a friend that works at Nestle and over in Poland, and I know she's told me stories about how they'll look for trends in other countries and find kind of innovative new products and then buy them and then reverse engineer them and figure out what makes sense for the Polish market. That's cool.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. It's fun work. It's challenging because the labeling requirements vary so widely by country. So in the US, for example, it's tough because things can be just labeled spices and it takes really a skilled panel to figure out what those spices might be. But other places where they have to declare what's in it, it's a lot easier because you don't know the proportion, but you know greatest to least and you know what those spices are, right? So you can be a little bit more targeted.
Yeah. And I think what I also find interesting about that part of the job slash, you know, what you're describing with some of these big food companies is that I feel like that trend over time kind of snowballs, right? Like you do so many of those, let's figure out how to replace this ingredient or figure out how to get costs down or whatever, that let's say after that product has been on the market for 20 years or 30 years, it might be almost unrecognizable from the original product, which, you know, the consumers maybe have palate drift or they don't remember what it tastes like and whatever. And they just It's more or less the same to them because the frog in a slowly boiling pot of water, you're not going to notice it. But that also then creates an open space for startup food companies to come in and be like, you know what? This category used to have good food and I'm going to make it the right way again. And it's like, we're going to make it two or three times more expensive, but it's going to be the original intent of the experience. And then there's this kind of push-pull between those startup challenger brands and the main category owner, like brand lead.
Yeah, I think you're right. And the competition is good to make people have a little bit of a check and balance against just doing the cheapest, easiest, you know, least common denominator approach. And so I feel like startups are a really important piece of that puzzle, right? To say, sure, we do peanut butter and we do it well, but now the granola butter and the speculoos and these other, we developed a product called Mother Butter, which is a seed butter. Those are sunflower butter. They're starting to take a piece of market share. And then there's that, the pendulum shifts again, right? Where the big peanut butter people are saying, all right, we're losing share to these companies. Why don't we have better food? Why don't we have more interesting flavors? We need to innovate. And then it'll shift again, you know? So it's the way it goes.
Yeah, another example that comes to mind is probably a commonly known one of coffee in the United States, right? Like it probably was never, we never had the original like French or Italian kind of coffee culture, but coffee was probably much better than like what we ended up with at the ubiquitous diner coffee or Folgers instant coffee or something. And then companies like Starbucks or these micro roasteries came into play and started reminding people of what good coffee tastes like. But then some of those companies grow and become not as good. And then these other startups pop up and make this ultra awesome coffee. And just kind of the cycle keeps going.
Yeah. And there is always a percentage of the market who wants the best, right? And they'll pay for the best flavor. They're not price sensitive. If it's a $12 little jar of jam, but it's the best imaginable jam, they'll buy that over the $3 bottle. And I'm not one of those consumers. I'm super cheap when I walk the aisles, but I think it's important to have that opportunity because we do find with entrepreneurs that a really good way to get a start in this world is to say, I'm just going to use better ingredients, better product. It's going to be super premium. And that's my foothold. And then from there, obviously you can nuance it infinitely and it may not be feasible, but I think it's always a good way to go to start with quality rather than trying to undercut.
Yeah. Cause when I first was starting my business, taking some marketing classes, it still kind of stands out to me as a piece of advice that they said, as a small business, you cannot compete on price. Don't ever try to compete on price. So if you go to market like trying to compete with Amazon, Walmart or something, you're just going to get crushed, right? You got to compete on quality because that's something they can't always do. Right. That makes sense.
Right, I agree.
So that you were kind of doing that work with the Kingsborough Community College, but at some point you ended up moving over to Drexel. What caused that shift and kind of how or why did you end up starting that food lab?
So I'm a Drexel alum and have stayed in touch with many of my former professors, one of whom was the provost who recruited me back to Drexel. And it came from a really innocent question. We were a part of a different college called the Goodwin College of Professional Studies. Now we're part of the College of Nursing and Health Professions together with nutrition and have a health and health equity focus, which I think makes a lot of sense for the kind of work we do. In my opinion, it took a really long time for people to realize that food and health are connected in our university. In any event, I was asked as an alumnus of the program and someone who's working in the space to answer a question, which is, we are still, to my knowledge, the only research university, doctoral granting research university with a culinary program in the country. Of course, many, many programs have adjacent fields like the Cornell Hotel School and many great food science programs, UC Davis and so on. But culinary typically has been sort of at the post-secondary level, has been at like culinary institute type places like CIA or Johnson & Wales or community college. There really hasn't been a university degree in culinary arts straight up. There's like culinary management, food management, culinary science, and so on. Anomalies are bad generally in higher ed, right? So the question is either, who do we benchmark against? Or how do we leverage this unique thing and kind of own the space? And even though we think of higher ed as this like idyllic pastoral situation. It's very much a corporate environment, even as a nonprofit. And so I was brought in to offer some feedback as an alum to this committee that was trying to figure out the reorganization of the college. And they said, I think the committee was leaning towards getting rid of this culinary program. And they really said, we can't outdo CIA or Johnson & Wales, or there's online culinary was just starting to boom with, you know, Ruby and Escoffier and so on. They asked for my opinion. And I said, I think there's a unique opportunity here that it's not, I agree, we can't compete directly with a culinary school that has a legacy and new kitchens and so on. But there's really no one who is working at that intersection of culinary arts, food science, public health, hospitality management, and really shaping, really being thought leaders in the future of food and really building out a research program like the Drexel Food Lab in culinary. And I said, I think you guys should do it. And here's my report. And that was it.
Nice.
And a few months of silence. And then they said, I got a call from the provost who asked me to do the report. And he said, so do you want it? And I said, I don't know what you're talking about. He's like, well, we like your report and we want to move forward with it and we're going to hire. So I encourage you to apply. So I did. It's very strange and surreal to be back at my alma mater in the same space, physical space. And I'm very connected to this institution, and I'm really proud of the work we've been able to do. And I feel like I have having been on the student side of things, kind of get what I think should be done, what frankly wasn't done well when I was a student, and what we have the opportunity to do well here. And so it seems to be working.
Yeah. And I noticed when I can't remember if I was checking out your profile or the Drexel website or something like that, but I noticed that you have a mission of solving real world problems in sustainability, health promotion, and access. So was that part of your lead, is having this not only just be about training good culinary research students or product developers, but also like having a true mission behind it as well?
Yeah, it's interesting you bring that up. So the original model for the Drexel Food Lab was a Robin Hood model. And the idea was we would do work for big, bad food companies, you know, multinationals, new products or sensory tests or, you know, stuff, whatever they wanted. And we would use that revenue to offset the good food work, things like upcycling and food alternatives to drugs and healthy recipe content development, things like that. And what we quickly learned was that model didn't work because the big food companies and the small food companies all wanted the same thing, which was that good food focus.
Interesting.
Sustainability, health promotion, access. And so we quickly abandoned that model and started doing work, whether it was for a startup or a multinational or a government agency, around that. And I feel pretty strongly that all of our work should have some social value. It doesn't mean that it's all health food, whatever that means. I really don't believe in health food. I believe in healthy people. And food is a part of that. And that includes mental health. So I'm not anti-indulgence at all. But I really feel like we have a broken food system. We have a fragile food system. And we should be working to improve that. And improving it could mean different things. It could mean uplifting an entrepreneur so that they can pay better wages and get themselves out of poverty and bring something new and exciting to market. It could mean taking hidden sources of sodium out of a school cafeteria, which we've done. It took just one little menu tweak, took 1,300 pounds of salt out of the Philly school lunch program.
Oh my gosh. Wow.
It can be really, really rewarding in different ways, and it's not one size fits all. But we do turn down some projects that I may be personally fond of, but we just don't see them aligned with our social mission. So one of my favorites that's doing really well is basically a Capri Sun for cocktails.
Interesting.
Super like youth appealing cocktail product. I think it's a great idea. We referred it out because I'm like, I do not see how this is mission aligned. But then other stuff is. And then the other things we typically turn away are just technical limitations. You know, we can't do puff snacks because we don't have the right extruder. we're not expert in whatever, you know, resistant starches or things like that to do a super technical product, because all of our stuff is really driven on, we know enough food science to help people commercialize, but we're chefs and research chefs first and foremost.
For some of those technical limitations, is that something that, like, if you get enough requests for puffs, that you'd be able to justify the university investing in some of that equipment?
Yeah, I mean, we have done that with different projects. We also partner really well. So, you know, sometimes it's about finding the right person who does have it, or getting into a plant and doing that work offsite at someone's facility where they do have the equipment. So yeah, that definitely happens. You know, and I think that's true industry-wide. Like, no R&D lab has their own, like, HPP machine. So if you want to get something HPP, you send it out and then you test it and, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, makes sense. So in case there are any brands out there who haven't worked with food science product development teams, what are the common kind of entry points? At what stage in a process do clients come to you? And then what are some of the examples of ways that you've helped them with maybe some interesting case studies?
Sure. That's a great question. I think one recommendation I have is engage us, whether it's us or another food product developer, food scientist, culinary scientist, earlier. Sometimes we're brought in after there's already been damage to the brand, like something's on the shelf yeah. and now it's moldy and they don't want it to be moldy and they want to undo a lot of work that brought it to the shelf in the first place. Whereas if we looked at the formula, we would have been like, this is not a great idea. You should be processing it differently or adding a mold inhibitor or doing something differently so that you could avoid this problem. Just little things. And we miss things too, but like, I'll give you an example. Riboflavin, which is a component of milk, is very light sensitive. And if it's exposed to sunlight, it develops an off flavor. So branding and marketing people are really good at saying, like, here's the new look of your new milk drink, and it's in a clear plastic bottle because we're going to really show off the virtues of this. And it's like, any food scientist would be like, maybe you should look at how those gallons of milk have that, like, dimpled, opaque kind of thing going on. And there's a reason for that. And like, the glass milk jugs are not the norm. So, you know, undoing a lot of that stuff after you've had tens of thousands of bottles produced to deliver your milk product. So I would say bring people in early. The other thing is, the other advice I have is, make sure you're treating the problem and not the symptom. So we get a lot of requests for, like, shelf life. Everyone wants the longest imaginable shelf life. That I get that. But people try to tell us what they want is shelf life, but the way they ask for it is preservative, right? Mm-hmm. I need a preservative. I need to extend my shelf life. Well, and maybe you do. But what's the actual problem? What's happening to your product over time? And is that truly the best answer? So, like, a really common example is sweet baked goods. You can make sweet baked goods last a long time by adding all sorts of stuff you don't want in them, like invert sugars and corn syrup and things like that. Or you could talk to your retailer and say, I'm going to give you something that's super clean label and super delicious, but it's going to come to you frozen. And every night you're just going to slack however many you need and put them from the freezer to the fridge. And they're going to have a 1 week shelf life, but they'll last for a year in the freezer instead of the 30-day shelf life that I could get through invert sugars and mold inhibitors and, you know, innovative package design and so on. For some retailers, that is appealing. For some, it isn't. But our advice is always think through what the real problem is, instead of just saying, my stuff gets dry and crumbly after 30 days. What can you do to help me? You know, what can you add to help me, right? Those would be pretty typical challenges.
Do you have people coming to you ever as well for, like, new product innovation, like researching categories, figuring out, like, okay, well, there's these growing trends in these spaces, and based on what you do, here's some, like, five different product ideas, and then kind of working through them with that?
Yeah, that's our bread and butter, and that's our most exciting thing. Sometimes it happens through an upcycling project. You know, every day our plant churns off 4,000 pounds of carrot scraps. Like, what can be done with this? Or it could be, you know, I really want to do something in late night college food, but I don't know exactly, is it sweet? Is it savory? Is it handheld? Is it delivery? Like, what does it actually look like? Yeah, we love those projects. We just did a great case study is this product called Mother Butter, which is a seed-based butter, sort of a peanut butter alternative. And it was developed around the request from the entrepreneur, her name is Kristen Dudley, it was around fertility and seed cycling and developing some foods with certain nutritional components. But what we found was that this also is a hypoallergenic butter. It's kind of a healthier alternative to sort of the Nutella or speculoos kind of butter thing. Yeah. But, you know, obviously it's slightly sweet, but much more nutrient dense. And so it's expanded a lot beyond, you know, the original vision, which was actually for sort of like a seed date cluster type thing, which is, I think, limited appeal. It's a great snack in the afternoon, but you're not going to have it breakfast, lunch, and dinner, to something that you could put on your oatmeal in the morning, you could pack in a kid's school lunch, you could take a spoonful of it in that hangry time at, you know, 5:30 when you just get home from work and you're too hungry to think about a healthy dinner, you know, all that, you know. So then we can kind of use a design process and a consumer-informed research process to take things a lot further than a lot of entrepreneurs come to us thinking about. So I guess that would be, thank you for that question, because that would be my other advice is don't fall in love with the product idea, fall in love with the opportunity, and then make the product to design the product to work with the opportunity. You know, yeah. That's the other thing, right? We talk a lot about, you can take a product approach of look what I can do, right? I can make the most delicious cookie. Good for you. You know, I say this to students all the time. If I say, here's a delicious cookie, do you want to try it? You'd be like, absolutely, sure. If I say it's going to cost $2, do you want to try it? You might lose a few, but most people would be like, sure. But if I put that cookie on the shelf and I give you a $20 gift card to the supermarket, the chances that that cookie makes it into your cart are like minuscule, right? So it's not just about making something good, which is, chefs hate this because they spend their whole life working on making something good. But that's really the easy part is the deliciousness, right? It's how is it aligned? How do you get a percentage of that stomach share, right? I'm only going to eat one lunch today. How do I make sure it's yours and not someone else's? All of those things, I think, is really where the art, the science, the business all coalesce. And it's a really exciting, you're getting me excited for my next semester product development course.
Nice. Yeah, that kind of reminds me of a friend of mine was kind of one of the innovators in cricket protein, right? So coming to market with something like that, where it's going to have this like off-putting question marks in consumers' minds. Right. And it's a brilliant idea and it makes total sense. We should be sourcing more protein from insects, right? Like other countries do it. But it's one of those things where, like you said, if you put a cricket bar in the supermarket, what's the percent of chance of it being picked up? There's just so much consumer education that needs to go along with that, that it's like he was 10, 20 years too early on that idea. And it's great that he got it started, but it's like, is that the thing that's going to grow? Or are there other ways you can still promote cricket protein, but not go against the market trend, you know?
Right. Because we talk a lot about really keeping that consumer benefit first and foremost, right? And no, I don't think anyone has ever said, my body needs protein, but I wish it would come from bugs, right? That's not a value proposition. Now, saying I want it to be more sustainable than animal-derived protein from other animals, like now maybe you're onto something, right? Or maybe it's the novelty. I'm bored with other, you know, animal proteins or something. Or maybe it's better. It's a more complete protein than others. Like, really digging into like, what is your value proposition? What is the real benefit you're offering? So the other example I give a lot in teaching is the technology exists. Like, why are chocolate bars rectangle? Like, does the technology exist to make triangle shape bars, Hershey bar in a triangle? Of course it does, right? But it doesn't really offer any benefit. And then there's always like some student who thinks they're being more clever than me, say, well, what about Toblerone? They're like triangle shape. It's like, great. So what does that benefit offer? Well, that really unique texture and eating experience. And that if it was in a square bar, it would be like really dense and tough to chew. But the pyramid and the cuts, the pips allow you to eat it in a really different way. And then they like start to think through that, right? So I agree. We get that a lot, especially from chefs, of like, I have an amazing hot sauce and I want to bottle it. It's like, there's nothing wrong with that, but what are you doing that isn't currently being done?
Yeah, there's 10,000 other hot sauces on the market. Like, what's different about yours?
Right, right. Now, and you could say that the 9,999th one was not the end. There is room, but you really have to think through, you know, what that offering is.
Yeah, that makes sense. So one quick other note, you mentioned the consumer kind of research side. So is that something that you manage internally or you connect with other groups?
Both, depending on the opportunity. So I'm trained in ethnographic methods from my doctoral work at NYU. So we're comfortable doing some of it on our own. We also work within the university, especially for quantitative and neuromarketing, like higher tech stuff that we don't do internally. So for example, our marketing and our, we have a relationship with our marketing department and our School of Biomedical Engineering. So we can do eye tracking studies. We can do FNIRs where we can actually brain image, like which messaging works better in your brain, is more quicker to understand, or pricing. So a lot of really sophisticated stuff that I understand in theory, but couldn't look at a data set and tell you how to price things. We work together with those folks. And we're also brought in by some branding companies, which we love doing. So sometimes a company will hire a branding firm, and branding firms are really good at doing the consumer work and the positioning. And they'll say, all right, you guys need to appeal to busy working parents who are not that comfortable in the kitchen, and you need to provide the dinner solution, and like, that's your market and that's the brand, and we did all this work for you. Well, that's wonderful, but they still don't know what the product is, right? So is it in a bag? Is it in a pouch? Is it in a box? What does it taste like? What does it look like? So we're often brought in by folks like that to come in and sort of put some flesh on the bones of like, what is the actual food product that we can design based on that branding work. And so that's a really good collaboration as well.
Nice. Okay, that makes sense. Let's flip it around. So we're talking about like what you can do for brands. What about the students that come through the program? What are the opportunities there for them on the other side of this program? Like, where are they typically placed and what kind of roles or what kind of companies?
Yeah, well, so some of them become their own brands, which is really exciting. So
that's cool.
We've had some student startups come out of the lab. You know, they feel like they've done enough work for other people. It's time to do their own thing. So there's a great example of an upcycled product called Reveal Avocado Seed Brew, which was developed in our lab by a master's student in culinary arts and science, Sheetal Bayurat, and another master's student in food science, Zuri Masood. And they're on the market, you know, just from they worked a lot on our upcycling work and just decided to do their own upcycled product. So we have examples like that. We have a restaurant, a startup kind of fast casual pasta concept that was started by a couple of our culinary students called Farina Pasta and Noodle. And some other students at the university come to us for support. So there's a business student who has a banana bread mix called Sasa's Mix that's based on a family recipe and so on. So we do that kind of work, which is really rewarding. Students can go into any number of roles. So one of the most exciting things is when students become our clients and say, I'm really busy at work. First of all, I need an intern or a co-op from you. And second of all, can you take this project off my desk and can we contract with you to do some work? So that's always really rewarding. And so a lot of them go into R&D, food technologist roles, or culinary roles, you know, not necessarily in CPG, but in food service or in restaurants, corporate. So it runs the gamut. I think one of the really exciting things is everyone sort of knows what a chef is, and people go to culinary school thinking they're all going to be chefs. And in high school or wherever you are before college, you know, you probably don't know much about what a supply chain manager is, or what a research chef, or what a compliance and labeling expert is. And so there are all these roles that you're exposed to, and students get excited about all sorts of things during their time. But to one of your points you made earlier, I think what's unique about our students is because we're culinary arts and science, and the lab is multidisciplinary, they're not just food technologists. They could go into a food technologist role, but we're seeing a lot more demand for students who can also do something else. So if they're a food technologist who can also cook at a culinary school level, or they also have a degree in nutrition and can help with compliance or help with the healthfulness of the products being developed, it gives them a lot more kind of appeal and versatility. And because all of our students get the consumer design work as part of their development, I think that helps as well.
That's cool. I don't know if you do much advocacy or kind of awareness around the different career paths in food, but as you mentioned, when you're in high school, most people, when they think about culinary arts careers, they think about, oh, I can go be a chef or open my own restaurant. But there are so many other paths, and I wish I had known about those, because like food is one of my passions. It's like food, business, sustainability, design, like all those kind of things circle around. And I thought about going culinary arts path, but I just felt like the working in restaurants for the rest of my life wasn't necessarily my path. So I chose to work. I also like creativity and design. So I ended up working in design with food companies. But if had I known there were these kind of like more research or creative product development paths in culinary arts, I might have still pursued that path.
Yeah. No, it's really challenging. I mean, we're even educating some of our colleagues, you know, on faculty and admissions and so on, because, you know, you run the SIP code in the Department of Labor or the Department of Education, and you put in, you know, food preparation, and they say, okay, here's your average wage and here's the percent growth. And there's some value in that, but it's big data. It doesn't always reflect the lived experience of what the opportunities are on the ground, right? We as an industry, I think, need to do a better job of telling our story to our future colleagues. It's a challenge. The industry is, our practice has been to obscure things a little bit. We don't open our books and we don't open our plants, and we're not really welcoming to the consumer. Everything's kind of buttoned up, and if you have a problem, you write to info@, and you don't always see the human behind these products. And I think it's a challenge. I think we're shooting ourselves in the foot in a lot of ways, not being more collaborative with K-12 and with colleges. We get a lot of tremendous industry support, and we're grateful for that. But it's not just encouraging people to pursue this path, right? It's really opening plants and doing tours and welcoming interns and doing a lot to kind of bring up our next generation. Because I don't think I've ever talked to anyone in the food business who says, I'm fully staffed and we're good right now. It's always like, who can you send me? I need people. We're growing. And that's wonderful, but it has to be supported. We need to raise all boats.
Yeah, that makes sense. And we're just about out of time, but I want to ask you one more question. So maybe you can keep your answer brief, but you've worked in food for so long and you're kind of have your finger on the pulse of like where the food industry is going. So in your opinion or based on your perspective, what is the future of the food industry?
Wow. Nothing like an easy wrap-up question.
Yeah, I should have saved more time for that one.
I think the future is going to be connectivity and transparency and communication. I think people are increasingly savvy about where their food comes from, how it's made. People have access to that information and people want to know that information. And the technology allows us now to know if there's a problem, God forbid, we know exactly what time that can came down the line and who was on the shift and who touched it. And we can get the closed circuit camera footage. But I don't think we should be only reacting to problems using that technology, right? I think we should be letting consumers know why they're eating, what they're eating, what decisions we made that went into this food, taking their thoughts and feedback. I mean, these companies have major budgets and major people doing research, and sometimes, and that's wonderful, and we obviously need that, but sometimes they're not listening to their own customers talk about what they want and what ways to improve. So I think it's all about kind of working together to meet everyone's goals, right? We can make money and provide a better product and that's more aligned with what people want.
That's awesome. Great answer to that. Sparks lots of ideas in my mind. So thank you for that. And thank you for all that you do for the food industry and for all these kind of brands trying to put out better products and make them last longer and make them more nutritious. And I love the kind of mission angle of your food lab. So thank you for all that you do. And thanks for taking some time to share your story with us.
Yeah, thanks for asking me.
Subscribe to our podcast and YouTube channel for more innovator interviews, expert advice, and leadership discussions. If you like this episode, leave a heart, thumbs up, or review, and share it with your colleagues. As an ever-evolving show, we also love feedback, so send us your thoughts or ideas for who we should talk to next to evolve@modernspecies.com. Business can be a powerful force for good. Is your brand living up to its full potential? Go to evolvecpg.com to learn about our new impact workshop, Exponential Good. Over 6 weeks, we'll be thinking bigger, getting relevant, spreading throughout, going exponential, working backwards, and making it real so you can walk away with a clear vision and a detailed action plan for scaling your brand's positive impact exponentially. Thanks for listening. If you'd like to learn more about Jonathan or the Drexel Food Lab, this is a long one, go to drexel.edu/CNHP/research/centers/food-bio-nutrition-core/drexel-food-lab, and you'll find the information. Or do what I did and just Google Drexel Food Lab, and you'll find that link.